That is because we're going to talk to someone who is not quite in the same time zone. I'm talking North Mariana Islands, a little place called Saipan. And so it's very, very early in his morning. It's also a name some of you longtime veterans will recognize, Mr. Vin Armani. We haven't heard from him in literally years. We just reconnected on LinkedIn. He has a really awesome new book that we're going to be talking about today. And we're going to be looking at his home for quite a few years now. He headed out there right as COVID began ramping up. A place called Saipan, which I think a lot of people don't know is a U.S. territory. And any American citizen can just go there, live there, work there. But it's also like the way we're going to come at this today, it's kind of the edge of empire. And when empires have gone into decline historically, you always see the edges first. You go into ground zero, dead center, where all of the wealthy people and all of the citizens live, where all the resources are most concentrated, and it can look normal even though it's in decay. But when you go out to the edges, it becomes very visible, as I used to say, immediately obvious to even the most casual observer. But that also might be an opportunity. So that's what we're going to have Vin on to talk about today in just a moment. Before we do, I would like to go ahead and recognize our sponsors of the day today. So up first, one of our newest sponsors, I think we have one newer sponsor than these folks, but this is Biltong USA. That's Anton Van Buren. He moved here to the United States quite a few years ago from South Africa as he was watching South Africa descend into a police state. And Biltong in South Africa is like hot dogs at a baseball game in America. It is a national treasure. And it is also delicious. So when COVID started and he had his little restaurant he had just opened shut down, he started shipping Biltong all over the country, kind of blew up from there. And now he makes some of the best stuff you'll ever eat. Biltong, the Druwer sausage, that's a traditional South African dry sausage using the same seasonings as Biltong. Kalabanazi, which is more of a Middle Eastern dry sausage. He also has Biltong sticks and a ton of really cool stuff that he imports from all over the world. So check him out. Loyal sponsor, been with us, I think, like 4 years, even though he's one of our newest sponsors. Our sponsors do tend to stick around. Next up, this has got to be our oldest sponsor that's still here. They weren't first, but they've been around the longest, KnifeKits.com. These guys signed up as a sponsor in 2009. I don't know if you've looked at a calendar lately. It's 2026. They're almost old enough as a sponsor to be legal to drink. That's a long time to sponsor a podcast. KnifeKits.com is a great company. They do what they say and say what they do right there in the title. All the stuff you need to make a knife in kit form, or if you want individual materials, really exotic stuff, mammoth tusk, buffalo bone, things like that, they have that as well. Plus all the stuff you need to make sheaths, plus the instructional materials you need if you've never done it before. And this is what I always say, like, this is a great project for you dads, grandpas, uncles to do with your grandson, your son, your niece or nephew, anybody like that. Build something like this with them. Knives are things that people keep around a long time. It becomes a family heirloom, even if it's not the best work you'll ever do, because your first one never is. With that, let's bring Vin on. Hey, Vin, welcome back to the show, man. Have not had you on air with me, I guess, since about 2022.
Really? I think it may have been longer than that. Can you hear me?
You're locked up, man.
Oh, no.
Of course you are.
Oh, no.
You're frozen on the screen.
Can you hear me at all or no? I'm just frozen.
And you're all modulated, too.
Oh, shoot.
What helps a lot of times with this, why don't you try just jump out of the room and jump back in? That might unfreeze.
Yeah, let me do that. Let me do that.
And we'll just wait for him to come back. This is the... Look, and all of a sudden you're working again. Now you're good. You there? Can you? Maybe he can't hear me. I don't know. He's locked up again. All right. There we go. So hopefully he'll be back in just a minute and we can get this going again. This is many, many thousands of miles of communication happening in real time here. So hopefully he'll be back in just a minute. I apologize for that. I'm really excited to talk about his new book with him. I really dug it listening to it. And here he is let's try this again as we look at the swirl. There we are. Vin, welcome to the show, man.
Man, thank you. Yeah, this is the happy chaos that is Saipan, especially now after a couple of disasters, a couple of big typhoons with this crazy weather pattern. Everything is a little bit on the fritz, which kind of it's you started it off talking about what it looks like when empire decays, and infrastructure is definitely the hallmark of that. And so we're experiencing it, and you guys just got to experience live what that looks like.
That's why infrastructure in full-scale warfare is always the first thing you attack, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. shut down infrastructure, you shut down the ability to transport food and communicate and all the things you need to keep a society running. But let's start off with a little bit about, like, why did you go to Saipan in the first place? And what has your life been like since you made that choice?
So I was, as you said, this was mainly a decision made in the midst of the COVID stuff. There was something around 2020, so I think people who have been around you during that time will remember that I was very adamant at that time that this is not going to be 2 weeks to save grandma, and that there are going to be very few places in the world that are not affected by this. Like, even if you're not directly affected by some weird draconian thing where they're forcing you to do certain things, that everybody's going to be affected because we're, and this is part of what we're talking about, because we're within an empire that's weaved into even internationally, right? And so mm-hmm. I was in Southern California, where unfortunately we had moved from New Hampshire because I'm originally from Southern California, and we had just had our second child. So we had a little baby under 1 year old, and we moved back just to be around family. And the city that I'm from, San Bernardino, it's an older city. It's a little more conservative, certainly, than LA, very much more conservative than LA. And I have a lot of family there. But when COVID hit and we just, you know, I was in California, I couldn't get into my office anymore. Our kids couldn't go on play dates, couldn't go to the beach. People don't remember. They were arresting people on the, maybe your audience remembers, but so many people don't remember. They would arrest you for doing yoga on the beach. They would arrest you for sitting on the beach contemplating in California. They'd arrest you at the parks for going on the swings. And so I said to my wife, okay, I looked at Gavin Newsom's face. I'd been in California my whole life. I knew this guy. I saw him smirking in that Joker smirk. And I said, this is not going to be 2 weeks to save grandma. So I told my wife in March, I said, okay, where are we going to go? And I didn't want to, you know, a lot of people went to Texas, obviously. A lot of people went to Florida. I think they did better than most. I thought that this was going to have long-reaching consequences just in general. And so we were looking at all the places that our friends had gone to. And it had just turned out that not before COVID, maybe November 2019, maybe October, somebody had told me that Mark Edge from Free Talk Live had gone to Saipan. He was a friend of mine. I lived in New Hampshire. I was co-hosting their show once a month. Called him and said, what is this place? What is Saipan? He told me all about it, connected me with some people here. So when COVID hit, I called those people and said, what's it like? What's going on? And they were sending me back pictures of the stores. They're like, look, we got all our toilet paper. Nobody's running around. Nobody's wearing a mask. And I said, okay, this is interesting. So we looked around. You couldn't at that time travel internationally. If people remember, the borders were all closed. You couldn't go anywhere. So that was out for us. We had friends all over. So we decided this is the place, or at least that we would look. And when the governor here said that they were going to shut down the island to all internal and external plane traffic on April 5th, 2020, I told my wife, we're on that plane. And here we go. And so we came in, and it was wonderful. I mean, we were able to spend the whole entire COVID period. Basically, I mean, there were no lockdowns, no mask mandates. We're in Asia, basically. So we do have a big Asian population, and they were kind of wearing masks voluntarily, but there were no mask mandates, no vaccine mandates, which was nice. They were very respectful of the religious exemptions. This is a very, very Catholic place, very right. Catholic. It's woven. Christianity is woven into everything. Like there's prayers before governmental, you know, events and things like that. There's definitely no separation of church and state. This is a Christian place. And so they were respectful of that. And yeah, my kids spent that whole period and to this day, like hanging out with their friends, no masks, totally normal childhood. And so it was a blessing in that regard. And we just fell in love with the place. We fell in love with it. It's unique in every way. Its history is unique. It feels very familiar and yet completely foreign. It does have a U.S. system of government, but it's brand new and kind of a petri dish that they've slapped on it since the 70s. So you get to see things stark in terms of, oh, that's weird that we do that in the U.S. Why do we do that? And then you see it at the small scale and you're like, oh, that's how that worked initially. Oh, that was actually a pretty good idea when it was at a small scale. Okay, pretty cool. And so I just became fascinated. I can work from anywhere as a software developer and had for many years. So we stuck. Beautiful weather besides these two typhoons we just got hit with. And since then I've had the opportunity to, I think to play a positive role here. I've helped. I mean, I've written laws here, which is crazy that have gotten passed, and regulations, consulted. I mean, I'm on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. I'm a member of the board of directors of our development bank. It's that you can have that kind of an impact here, in the U.S. And so it's been really interesting. I've grown a lot. I would still consider myself a libertarian anarchist, but at this scale, it's anarchy anyway. Because everybody knows everybody. Everybody's related. We only have 50,000 people here, if that. It's been a really interesting experience. And I think this is probably where I'll spend the rest of my life.
I can definitely understand that. I mean, just some of the pictures you shared with me when you first went there, the place is beautiful. It's not pristine everywhere as far as maybe some of the infrastructure and stuff like you said. I'm talking about the geography.
Oh, yeah.
Like the beaches and all. And it seems very affordable to live as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because there are things that are certainly more expensive, like fuel. I think we're at like around about $6, maybe $6.10 for regular gasoline per gallon. But you know, if I go to the store and I'm buying like the local produce, I get giant cucumbers for like $1. You know what I mean? Local lettuce for 50 cents, that type of thing. And so, and you don't drive that far. So gas is expensive, but it's only, you know, maybe you are only driving 2 miles a day and the speed limit is 35 miles an hour. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like the gas price doesn't even matter. You're talking about a place you probably could get by with a friggin' golf cart or something.
Well, you can't. You're going to need a 4x4. Like everybody here has trucks. Right. Everybody here has trucks. It's mountainous. This is the Marianas chain. People have heard of the Marianas Trench. So the Marianas chain of islands is the top of the mountain range that's coming out of the trench.
Okay.
So most of them, Saipan in particular, is what they call a high island. So it's got Mount Tapachao, which is the mountain here is a former volcanic mountain. And so is the big one out in Pagan. So I think it's about 2,000 feet elevation and it hits that fast. So it hits that within a half mile from the beach.
It has to, right? Just geometry says. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But like next to us is Tinian and that's a pretty flat plateau, but it still is, I don't know, maybe it's coming up 100 feet off the water. So everybody here has 4x4s. Everybody does. Not everywhere is paved. For my road, just to get to my house. Yeah. You definitely need 4x4 in the rain. No question.
Okay. All right. So let's start talking about some of the stuff you're doing now with your work and your books and all.
Sure.
You frame sovereignty as a vertical relationship under a divine landlord. How does that challenge the conventional political view that land ownership is merely like a horizontal claim established by material strength and historical longevity? In other words, like it sounds more like a stewardship is what you're saying to me.
Yeah, and people have always viewed it that way. right? This idea that it's horizontal is like really, really new. If you think about it, it's even really new in terms of the U.S. and Western experience, because even the idea of manifest destiny is really saying that God has given us this land. Like God has the white man's burden, if you will, right? The idea was that God has blessed certain cultures with his abundance and his mercy. And those cultures, then the reason why they are taking over these other places or why they should rule these places is because these places belong to God. That's the underlying foundation there, right? These places belong to God. God has chosen a people, and God wants those. He has chosen them to rule over this land. So this is both obviously ancient, and it's something that, you know, this is part of the whole Israel justification. But the U.S. used it as well. That was manifest destiny. That was what was underlying this idea of we need to civilize the savages. And so the idea that there's this horizontal person-to-person title actually only exists after you're – it can only exist in the inside, right? So we take it for granted because we're inside a settled, established empire where there is no outsider that we have to deal with. But the second that you're dealing with somebody who is not sharing your system of title, right, or who is challenging your system of title, then you have to appeal to a higher power if you want to do it peacefully. Of you say you own this, I say I own this. We have no way of adjudicating this, so there needs to be a higher power above us that can judge. And so that's where you get the God as king, God as judge, etc.
Okay. Can you unpack the systemic distinction between importing capital goods versus cargo? Like that was a thing that I got out of your book, and explain how a reliance on finished consumable goods actively strips a population of its traditional production skills. And it will erode self-sufficiency, right? Because the way I look at that is I believe our government has kept territories like Saipan limited in their ability to develop so that they remain dependent, because you don't want them actively pulling away from you when they're thousands of miles away and you don't have the, like, people think the government has unlimited resources. We do not. No government does. And this little island out here has a lot of value to us in some ways from a tactical standpoint, but we can't really invest in it heavily. So we need it dependent enough. So if we rob those people of the skills of independence, then they remain dependent.
Yeah, this is the most interesting thing about being out here in the Marianas. And so I think the first thing that I need to, because people don't know about this place, it is the hidden part of the U.S. empire for sure. But people might remember, do you remember this, Jack? You probably remember this. When Pete Hegseth was having his, what do they call that? His confirmation hearing in the Senate. And they said, what do you think is the most important, like, what is our most important strategic location? I don't know whether they said the Pacific or whether they said the world, but they for sure at least said the Pacific. And he said, well, I think Guam is pretty important. Like the first thing out of his mouth was Guam.
Yeah.
Right? So Guam is the southernmost island in our chain. You can actually see Guam from our southernmost island in the northern. So there's Guam and then there's the Northern Mariana Islands as separate U.S. jurisdictions. The Northern Mariana Islands is where I am. The capital is Saipan. But the southernmost island of the Northern Mariana Islands that's inhabited is called Rota. And you can see Guam from Rota. Right. So in terms of how strategic this entire archipelago is, it's pretty clear. And for you to, you know, it's interesting. There is no military presence in the Northern Mariana Islands to speak of whatsoever. However, in terms of investment, there are hundreds of billions of dollars a year invested in Guam. And even more so now than ever, because they're removing the military presence, the longtime military presence from Okinawa, and they're moving it all to Guam. right? So this region is being heavily invested in, but only on one island. And what's interesting about that fact is that that has actually been the pattern of empire. So the Spanish had this as part of their empire. They actually depopulated all the rest of the islands and moved everybody to Guam. Then the Japanese had the same sort of situation. They basically did the same thing with the native population and imported Japanese and Korean workers when they had control over it, right? So it's interesting because the island of Tinian, which is just to the south of me, you can see it. You could swim there if the channel wasn't ridiculously like deep and crazy water. It's only about 6 miles away. So you stand on Saipan and you could see Tinian. It's there. When people settled Tinian, they had traveled the longest overwater voyage. This is about 3,500 years ago. They had traveled the longest overwater voyage of any human beings ever that we know of. Maybe there was a past civilization or whatever, but in terms of our understanding of history, and Tinian was the first settled island in all of Oceania. So you see how close they are, Saipan and Tinian. Tinian was actually the last island that was fought over in World War II. There was a huge battle of Saipan and then the battle of Tinian. Most of the troops were on Saipan. And Tinian, the airfield at the north of Tinian, is actually where the two bombers that dropped the atomic bomb launched from. So when we talk about the end of empire, it truly was. They wrested that from the Japanese, and then that was the last island they needed to go on before they had the range of their bombers. And so it's a very, very important place, and still you could go out and see the bomb pits where they dropped it. But what's important to know is people had been living here. This was the first island in Oceania, Tinian was, that was settled by people. So of all the islands in all of the Pacific islands, the first one settled was Tinian because it's perfect. It's flat. It's a table. That's why they used it as an airbase.
I was going to say, you want to land on flat surfaces.
Exactly.
Especially in 1940s.
It's basically a gigantic aircraft carrier.
Okay.
Basically, it's a gigantic unsinkable aircraft carrier. But interestingly enough, because we have Guam, you don't need it. But the people here for 3,500 years had been able to produce for themselves, highly productive, so much so that this was a trading outpost for the navigators to come and get all kinds of stuff. They were more advanced here because they had been here longer. So this was a place that the people to the south, like in the Caroline Islands, Yap Chuuk, which is now called the Federated States of Micronesia, they're like the greatest navigators in the world still to this day. They can navigate the whole Pacific on canoes. They would travel up here to get metal because they were doing metal working up here and everybody else was in the Stone Age. But these people, this is before the Spanish, right? So they were hyper developed here. When the Spanish showed up and they came into the lagoon, they recorded that they counted 500 sails of sailboats. And these were called the flying proas. They were faster than the Spanish galleons. They could easily outrun the Spanish galleons. And they would do the trip from here to Philippines in 4 days on a sailboat. These things were so fast. They're ridiculously fast. And they would trade. This is before the Spanish.
No, I got
this. This is before the Westerners got here.
1,200 years here right now.
So they've been doing it the whole time. So clearly, when you get to, so you think about, okay, how advanced, how abundant does your society need to be before you can develop a boat that can do a run from here to Manila in 4 days?
Yeah, I think the way to reframe that to get people to get their head around it is you have to think of the time that this was going on, and Spain was the most dominant country in the world at the time you're speaking of. So it would be like today having some small tropical island have Seacraft that can outrun the most advanced ships that we have in our Navy.
That's right.
That's the analog, and it's the same thing. It's just a different time. You're going back, 1400s to 1600s there where the Spanish are involved. They basically had superior ability to navigate and move across the ocean over the most advanced government in the world. That is That is crazy. If you think about it happening now, like if we found the place that was doing that right now, we'd be like, we found Atlantis, right? I mean, that would be what you would say.
And I think that you've hit upon why this being in this place lit my mind on fire when I came here and realized what it represented in terms of a history. And then when I looked now and I'm like, wait a minute. I can't even buy Tinian beef. There still is lots of agriculture and there's Tinian beef. You saw how close it is. I can't buy Tinian beef in the store here. I know ranchers personally. I can't buy the beef from Tinian in the store here. I can only buy the beef coming from Texas. Think about that from an economic standpoint. I can stand on Saipan and see cows on Tinian with my naked eyes. No binoculars. They're that close.
Yeah, I understand.
I cannot buy that beef here.
Can you go there and get it?
Well, when the slaughterhouse is working, but USDA constantly comes in and shuts down the slaughterhouse. So basically what you have is you have to know somebody. That's how the locals get it. Their cousin is one of the ranchers. Sure. They chop up some meat. Yeah. They tell you, hey, we're bringing some meat. Same thing here. What's interesting is I can't buy any pork in the store here, right? That's locally raised. We have thousands of pigs and hogs. The governor, the former governor who's running again, has a piggery, a giant piggery. Okay. No one here I can't buy that in the store, but anytime I go to a local fiesta, they always have the pig.
Yeah.
So they always know somebody to buy. So there's an underground economy, but the U.S. at the USD, the level where you would need USDA certification, it's always prevented. So this is where you go like, oh, that's a, and not only that, but it's like, there's no other development. So 70% of the people are on food stamps and you can't buy the Tinian beef or the local pig with a food stamp. What can you buy with a food stamp? Well, you could buy the spam that they just brought in. You could buy the beef that came from Texas. You could buy. So this goes. Now we're going full circle.
You're eating my beef and I go to the store and I'm buying beef from Brazil and Argentina.
That's right. That's right.
If you really play it all the way through, that's how ridiculous this is.
That's
my
right.
Texas beef is going to Europe and Saipan and Japan.
That's right.
And if I don't do what I do, which is buy direct from ranchers, if I go to Kroger's or Albertsons, I'm usually buying beef that's from Argentina, Brazil, or Australia.
There you go.
This makes no sense, except if we look at it as an imperial strategy.
That's right.
Or like resource denial, which is kind of where you went with your book.
And that's you see that in a microcosm here. So, and this is one of the things I'm trying to point out in the book is that, and I'm glad that you got that piece, Jack, is like, this is happening everywhere in the empire. But when you remove the noise, like you could see it in Texas if you know what you're looking for.
Sure.
But there's so much going on in Texas, right? It's the scale is so huge that it's hard to wrap your head around all the moving pieces. But it's like coming and seeing a prototype or a toy model, right, of a system where there's not much noise and there's very few moving parts. And you go, oh, that's what this machine is? Right. It's like seeing a small model car where you can take apart the pieces or the little anatomy things they used to have in school where you can like pull off the little pieces and look. That's what you can do here. And so it's like, oh, that's how you control a people. That's how you take a people from without guns. They didn't do it without guns. The people accepted it willingly. Right. That all you have to do. And it was just a series of disasters. Between typhoons and wars, decimate a place, and then when the place is decimated, give the people a choice. You can either try to rebuild yourself or here's a boat full of food. Here's a boat full of supplies. Just take this. Oh, yeah. Money? You want money? You heard about the things that we have? Oh, take money. Oh, here, you want to come and get a – look, these degrees. Look at this paper. See this degree? Bachelor, master's, doctor.
Yeah.
You know, we have more per capita master's and doctorate people here among the local population than I guarantee you anywhere in the world.
It's crazy.
And it's all free education, by the way. It's all free. Like they'll, if it's free, if you will leave and go be indoctrinated in the States, that's 100% free if you're a local. Up to doctorate.
That's insane. That's insane. So you'll leave, you go to the States, and you can come back, obviously, but it's free. But it's not free for you if you live here. Right?
Right,
so
correct.
You can come to Texas from Saipan and go to college for free, but if you're in Texas, you got to pay.
Yes.
And then when you go back to Saipan, like, you're surrounded by other people with masters and doctorates and all, and there just can't be that much industry there that requires this.
Oh, no, because it's for the government.
Okay.
So you see, this is also an old tool of empire. The Byzantines used to do this. They called it the Janissary system. So there's, one of the more recent Dracula movies depicts this pretty well, to where basically what they would do is they would go to the Slavic princes who were part of the empire, who were the outskirts of the empire. So we're talking Hungary, Romania, all of those places in Eastern Empire now, the Slavic, Eastern Europe, the Slavic countries. They would force the princes to give their sons to the, oh, these are the Ottomans, I'm sorry, not the Byzantines, to give their sons over to the Ottoman Empire, right? And they would then convert them to be Muslims, educate them to be warriors and generals. They were the best generals, by the way. The Janissaries were known for being the best fighters. The Slavics, they were the best fighters of the Ottomans. But they took them from a young age, so they were basically Ottomans. Mm-hmm. And then they would send them back when their father died. They would send them back to rule that area, and then they never had to worry because the only culture that these princes knew was Ottoman culture. Right? They spoke Turkish. They were Muslim. They fought in that way. They were friends with the Sultan from childhood, et cetera. Right? And so the U.S. is doing the Janissary system as well. Take them off, they indoctrinate them, give them a high degree, send them back, and then they're just doing the U.S.'s bidding, not because they know that they're doing that, but because the values that they've been taught about what's important are the imperial values and not the local values. And so you get an elite who they're looking, their eyes are focused on D.C. and the mainland as the highest thing, rather than their own blood. That's like, hey guys, we were better than them.
Yeah. And this pattern is so common in history, and people don't realize it. Like, if you look at history in like Central and South America and like the Inca Empire, it ran the same way. The Inca king would like get a whole bunch of troops and then march into this neighboring city, and they're like, oh shit, they're here to kill us. And he's like, oh no, here's a bunch of free shit.
That's right.
And they would just lavish crap on them and say, the only thing we want is a place that when we visit to stay. And they would do the exact same thing. They would take their young, promising people back to their main, capital and say, we're going to educate them. And then they would return them. And we didn't hurt them. We didn't shoot them. Didn't torture them.
That's right.
But they would take over then as the vassal government. It's the same pattern.
Because it works.
That's why I don't believe in any of these utopias of like, well, this place was perfect. And once anything grows to a certain size, this type of thing always happens.
Always. And it always decays. So the thing is, all these empires that we're talking about are no longer there. And when they decay, they always decay at the edges first. And so those are also the most, you look at the places that became the most interesting places. And we've talked about where those places are already, right? But like certainly Eastern Europe, in that struggle with the Ottomans, just became the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The borders against Russia, like these were the most interesting places at the time when they, England, the Arthurian legend, I write about this in the book because I think it's the best example for certainly Americans. But, King Arthur, people don't realize it's a mythological story, but it takes place after the Romans left. So it's like Britain had Joseph of Arimathea, right, who gave Jesus the tomb. Orthodox tradition says that after that, he left Jerusalem and that he established a church in Britain. Joseph of Arimathea, right? So there was already Christianity for centuries. The British Empire was there for centuries. You go to the British town of Bath, right, in England. Bath, England is named that because of the Roman baths. Mm. Hadrian's Wall, there's Roman aqueducts.
Yeah, Hadrian's there was Wall, definitely.
Yeah, there was history.
The Scottish myths about the Grail, I mean, that has its roots that far back. That's
and so,
why
but,
it would be there.
But what's interesting is that the Romans had a ton of history about Britain. They had tax records. They had this whole thing. But then they left in the early 400s, and it slipped back into the mist of myth. Yeah. And you get King Arthur, and you get the Holy Grail, and you get the legends. And it's like, wait a minute. They actually – history stopped, and they went into legend. And then a new thing came out of it. But it's always it's the – I mean, look, the U.S. was the end of the empire too. The American colonies were the edge of the British Empire, and they became what they became, right? And so it's like constantly throughout history, you see what used to be the edge of an empire literally become the next world empire.
And would you say that's why, like, the reason these countries and empires do this is not out of some sense of morality or whatever, or like a desire like to make them our friends? It is out of necessity. Like, the only way they can maintain an empire large enough to enforce the rest of their empire is to have some of these edges. And so then they grant this apparent autonomy, but it really isn't, right? It's like, you're free to do anything you want as long as you do what we say.
Yeah.
And maybe they do have more autonomy than somebody here, but there's always a thumb on the scale.
Yeah, and it's always very subtle. You know, I mean, the biggest trick, I mean, Sun Tzu says it in The Art of War, right? The greatest excellence is not to fight and win, but to win without fighting. And so, you know, there's always the subtlety. In 1984, when they're talking about Newspeak, there's that scene in 1984 in the book where they're sitting in the cafeteria and the guy who's developing out the new language, Newspeak, is talking to them about the purpose of Newspeak. And to make a long story short, he basically says, look, the idea here is to train people in a language where they won't even have the capability to think of any kind of revolutionary thought. So it's not even that we're forcing them to think in a certain way. We've created the vocabulary such that the vocabulary itself prevents them from thinking something we wouldn't want them to think. And these are the subtle things, and it goes right back to the cargo. If you go into any store here, Jack, people should come here and experience this because it's so interesting. We don't have any supermarkets. We have all small stores. That's one of the interesting things here. We have like no chains. We have no national banks. We have none of that. Everything is small mom and pops everywhere. It's small business 100%, which is super, super cool.
That's cool.
But it is super cool, but they're also in many ways very homogenous. So like every corner store is kind of the same. So you get like kind of one big corner store in terms of what you could find in it. But go into any store here, walk in the door and walk to the first aisle. You know, when they do your inventory and you have like your first aisle is like the thing that most people come in. It is an entire aisle of Spam and Spam-like products. Which, if you're in a U.S. grocery store, you got to go searching for Spam.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You got to go searching
where the sardines and shit are. Like that's,
exactly. No. You walk in here, it is Spam and Spam like canned meat products is the first aisle that you go down. And so somebody coming from the outside, you look and you go, what? Like, what? What does it take to get to a society where that's normalized? And what does that mean at the deepest of levels? Because it's not, because that's just a symptom.
Yeah.
Right? That's just a symptom of something else to where if that was an American, from the States, they would walk in and go like, why on earth would you waste all of this space? But the thing is, those aisles empty out. Because when you're standing in line, there's people who got Spam. Everybody's checking out with Spam. If you encounter one of the few homeless people that usually they're not homeless. Usually they have a home, but they're drug addicted or something. Very few of them here, but they'll ask you, can you buy me some Spam?
Sure.
That'll be the thing that they ask for. They don't say buy me food. They say buy me spam. Buy me a can of spam.
That has a lot of roots in World War II. Of course it does. They don't have that problem in Hawaii, but spam is part of their culture. I've had mm-hmm. some pretty amazing things made with spam in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the same thing, except they just, like, Hawaii has also, like, it's a state. It has a much larger population. It has a military presence like Guam does, in fact, more so. And it has a ton of tourism, and it's a mm-hmm. highly developed place. So if you took all that away, it probably would still look very much like Saipan today.
So I would argue that the difference between Hawaii and Saipan in particular is that Hawaii wasn't conquered with cargo.
Oh.
So what you're looking at is you're looking at the weapon of conquest. Hawaii was taken by basically a U.S. intelligence action that overthrew their existing kingdom. I mean, they had, a very well-established, well-respected kingdom that was overthrown by, let's say, American, I don't know what you would call them, but they were intelligence agents, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. Early day intelligence agents that overthrew the kingdom from the inside.
They were here, we called it the Sandwich Islands before we took them, and sugar was the big money reason that we wanted that.
And sugarcane was huge here. In fact, the last time that this island was self-sufficient and it was very profitable was under the Japanese. That's what they did. They exported sugar. And there was actually one guy, private company, they called him the Sugar King. There's still statues to him around. And this island was highly productive. Saipan in particular was highly productive. But this place was conquered with cargo. It was conquered with cargo. It was completely destroyed. Saipan was completely destroyed in World War II. Almost all of the plants here are not endemic. They're not on this island. They're not native plants. They had to replant everything because it was completely wiped out. They just deforested everything with the bomb so that they could find the Japanese and kill them. Right. Okay. And it was a massive battle. But people can look up Battle of Saipan. Completely brutal. Absolutely insane. The things the Japanese did, it was their last stand, basically.
Sure.
So you could imagine what that looked like. So when that happened, there actually was no way to sustain the population. And the U.S. actually took the locals and the Japanese and Koreans. Remember, I said they brought Japanese and Koreans uh-huh. here. And they put them in concentration camps for 2 years.
Okay.
And during those 2 years, they fed them cargo, rations, spam. It was the military providing everything because they couldn't grow anything anymore. This had been a highly productive agricultural place. It was just completely deforested, everything gone. And so even through that, the people got accustomed to that. And some people just simply never left that. And the government of the U.S. was like, well, we'll keep giving you this. And they tried it in many islands. I was actually, there's a master navigator who lives here, who we've become friends because our church has been supplying fuel for them to deliver supplies after the disaster. And so we'll sit while his diesel tankers are being filled up and he'll tell me stories. And he said in 1974, around the time that they were developing to try to have the covenant here and the other negotiations to have the Marshall Islands, Federated States of Micronesia, Palau, that the Navy tried to bring cargo down to his island, which is Satawal. And they started bringing cargo. The people started using the cargo. And eventually the chief actually took a canoe and came up here and told the trust territory, I don't know what he was called, supreme commander or something like that, told him, stop sending us stuff. Our people aren't working. They're not farming. They're not fixing the canoes. You're going to destroy us. Stop sending this. Now, mind you, it had been 30 years that they'd been doing that already here in Saipan. And this supreme commander was like shocked. He's like, well, I don't, it's the U.S. trust territory that the UN had given after. And he's like, well, I got to tell the Navy. I don't know. I got to tell the admirals. You guys are just on the thing. So I guess they eventually did tell them. And so what he told me was the next time the Navy came, but they didn't come with cargo. They came with ducks, baby ducks. You'll appreciate this story. So they came with baby ducks. And the people were like, what are these? Obviously, they've never seen a duck before. And they're like, no, you're going to raise them. They're going to have, it's going to be eggs and all of that. And the people are like, okay. So they took the ducks And he told me his name is Cecilio, Captain Cecilio. He's probably the greatest master navigator in the world now that Mao, who retaught the Hawaiians how to do it, and his son have passed away. So as he can navigate the entire on a sailing. Go ahead.
You got about. We were both gone, and nobody could hear either one of us. We went black screen for 30 seconds. So just got to rewind about 30 seconds and keep going.
Yeah. Okay. So. The U.S. came with cargo, and the high commissioner, the chief went to the high commissioner, told them stop sending cargo. So the Navy came the next time and came with – so this is from Satawal. So this is in the Caroline Islands south of us, near Yap State now. And they brought ducks. A whole bunch of ducks, hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands of ducks for the people of Satawal. And they said, what are these? We don't know what this animal is. They said, these are ducks. You're going to raise them. They're going to give you eggs. They're like, we don't eat eggs, but okay. So they started raising these ducks. And he said a couple months later, they realized the ducks are eating all their vegetables. They're like, what the hell? These creatures, they're grown. They're eating all our vegetables. This is insane. So the chief said, okay, feast time. Kill all the ducks. we're going to have a feast. So the Navy came back the next time. This time they brought rabbits, right? And they showed up and they were like, hey, where are the ducks? And they're like, well, the ducks were eating all our vegetables. And they're like, okay, well, here's rabbits. And so, as you can imagine, the exact same thing happened. They raised the rabbits till the rabbits were old enough. Then they had a feast. They ate the rabbits. The Navy came back the next time. I don't know what they had this time, but they said, where are the rabbits? They're like, oh, well, the rabbits are in our stomachs. And yeah. So the Navy never came back. And the interesting thing about Satawal is they were the last place in Oceania. They still to this day have no power. The chiefs have not allowed it. They have no like municipal power, but they still have navigators. They still have the traditional medicine. So it was the guys from there that had to go and reteach. So the Hokulea, people could look it up when the Mao went and retaught the Hawaiians how to sail using the traditional navigation. And I think the first place they sailed was either to Fiji or Tahiti. He navigated it. They build the boats here. There's a lot of Satawalese here. They actually still build the canoes here, but they were the last place to have that technology that I told you about. And the reason why is they never took the cargo. They actively refused the U.S. cargo. And so they still to this day have the navigator tradition and have the technology we talked about that the Spanish were so impressed by.
Well, it sounds like what you have though is a state where you have like the governing elites are within a donation state. Mm-hmm. Like that's what you're actually dealing with when you compare it to someone that didn't allow it. And that means that the elites are going to be incentivized, right, to keep the infrastructure stagnant or broken. It needs to work good enough, but not too good, right? Like if you actually start developing the place the way that it could be, and I'm not even talking about necessarily developing it like bringing international tourism in or something. That's an opportunity. But I mean developing it to support the people that live there. That's what I mean. Like the more of that happens, then the grip becomes looser and looser. But if you can keep the people in charge, like the best thing for you to do is to go along with what we have and we'll make you very comfortable. Then you can maintain control with very little effort. Like we've got this group of islands because like you've mentioned Yap, you've mentioned Guam. The other, I can't remember what it is now.
Palau, right. Chuuk, Marshall Islands. Yeah,
there's a whole group, and they were all kind of brought captive during the World War II aftermath in pretty much the same way. These are all these territories, right? And I'm thinking they're probably all kind of run this way.
Yeah, in more and less. So the Northern Marianas was the first one to make a deal. And they made the deal for the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. What actually happened after that was quite interesting. And this is a hidden piece of history that you have to scour. It's out there because there's UN reports. But Jimmy Carter actually squashed the Senate report that Dan Inouye did. The CIA was wiretapping all of the leaders from all of those places. to try to figure out what they wanted. It was a huge scandal, but it's now been like swept under the rug. And so instead of they all potentially could have been U.S. territories. But they found out the CIA was wiretapping them, and so they all decided to be independent countries in a compact of free association. That's what we call them. So if you're a Palauan citizen, Marshall citizen, Federated States of Micronesia citizen, all of them, although they carry those passports, can go and live and work in the U.S. without a visa like a citizen, as though they were a citizen. Now, there's not many of them. Palau only has 18,000 people that live there. I think Marshall maybe has 20. FSM has, I don't know, maybe 100,000 between the four different states that they have, right? So we're not talking about a lot of people, a lot of impact, but that was the effect of what happened. In terms of the donation state and the elites, what's interesting is, you know, this actually, until very recently, really until COVID, this was a gigantic tourist destination. I mean, millions of tourists a year. We have some incredible hotels here. I mean, 5-star. I think there's 9 or 10 golf courses. 4 of them are PGA here. So that tells you how big of a tourist destination this was. Guam is the same way. Still huge tourist destination. COVID killed a lot of that. The markets is people you wouldn't know from the U.S. because we don't market to the U.S. We're only a 3-hour flight from Seoul, Tokyo. They used to have, I think, 40 international flights from China that were coming here on a weekly basis. We've had a lot of Chinese investment over the years, but now obviously they're trying to fight that. And that's really what it's been here is the elites in many ways are able to, both in legitimate ways, like being sure that they're daughters and sons and nieces and nephews are the ones who get the jobs that go along with some government grant to build infrastructure, or illegitimate ways of just simply siphoning off some money. Our accounting is very bad here, right? So I can't accuse anybody, but the U.S. government is like, you guys need to turn in an audit to us. And we'll have tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of unaccounted. Well, we don't know where that went. You know what I mean? It's that type of thing in the small community. The U.S. is actually okay with tourism as an industry. What they're not okay with, when we first negotiated the covenant, so the U.S., while this place is called a territory, it's not. And the U.S. courts have said it's not a territory. It's something different. They don't exactly know what it is.
They don't know what it is.
They don't know what it is. Yeah, the courts have said it's not exactly, we're not exactly sure what it is. We would need a lot more court cases to figure out what this thing is. But there's a unique arrangement called the Compact to Establish a Commonwealth of the United States, a Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands in political union with the United States. And basically everyone here is a citizen, but we have this different level of sovereignty. For instance, you and I can't own land here.
Correct. Yeah, I looked that up.
Yeah, so that's an interesting aspect that's different than Guam, different than Puerto Rico, right? It's not a U.S. territory in that regard. So the elite really are elite here. They can own land and I can't, right? I'm really a second-class citizen. There really is an aristocracy here, a literal aristocracy that's embedded in U.S. law because the compact is U.S. law. What they're not okay with here is, and we know this, in the 90s, there was the garment industry. So you are old enough to remember there was this period in the 90s when it was like the side designer brands where you had like Polo Sport, Nautica, DKNY, like all of these were like everywhere. So all of that was made in Saipan, all of it.
Okay.
And it was all Chinese sweatshops, basically.
Okay.
And because the covenant gave CNMI its own immigration system, we still have our own customs. So by the way, all the tariff stuff, we have no tariffs here.
Okay.
We have our own customs. I can import anything without the U.S. tariffs stuff here.
Okay.
Okay. It's a different tariff system. Although if I export something from here to the U.S., it's domestic.
So we have no tariffs either way. Right. Okay. I got you.
Right. And so you could see what that means before China was in the WTO, and you could still see the husks of all of the factories, the garment factories that were here. That was where, do you remember the Abramoff scandal? Tom DeLay and the Abramoff scandal?
Yeah.
That was here. They got so wealthy here. The elites got so wealthy that there was a famous politician here who said, there's Chamorros and Carolinians are the native people. Every Chamorro family has a right to at least one Filipino maid. That was said from and the guy who was running it all from the Chinese, Willie Tan, who Tan Holdings is still here. He basically owns Skechers of China, is the Tan family. He got caught on a hidden camera saying that he can just pay Tom DeLay to get whatever he wants from out of the Congress. And that's how the Tom DeLay scandal happened. And that's how we lost our immigration. So the problem that they have is the problem that the U.S. has is this place is so productive in terms of the way that it's built up is that if you don't block it, this little tiny place can influence the Congress because the amount that it could generate per capita. And so like this is before the Gulf states were doing this. But look, the Saudis and the Emiratis do this now. They just do it in a very much more subtle way where they're like, we're going to buy this company over here and this and this. They don't just hand an envelope. We did it in a very like
over the table, direct. Hey, we're paying for shit we want it way, right?
And but so that, that was it. Like it was. You could have U.S. It said made. They said made in Saipan, USA. So no, you're not in the WTO. You come here. You have no tariffs. You assemble the stuff. You build your garments. You ship them into the U.S. And that's how you got that glut of fast fashion that was in the 90s. It was all made here. And so the U.S. is constantly trying to keep this place down because it's very, very scared because it's just like the Slavs, right? You should be scared. If you take all these princes and you educate them in war and you do all of these things and educate them about business and you educate them about how your government works and then you send them back, that's what that Dracula movie is about.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Is the idea that it was like he was trained by them. So he knew how to fight them. So it's like, look, educated all these people, you've sent them back. You need to be sure that they don't figure out that they could be highly productive.
That's another example of the classic two cultures come together and both are convinced they can use the other. You never really know how that's going to work out until you put some time on it and see where it goes. Let's talk about some other stuff though, like, cause your book, which is The Vineyard and the Vessel, outlines a bunch of this, but you also seem to think there's tremendous opportunity. What is the opportunity that lies in the North Mariana Islands right now?
Well, it's the opportunity is interesting, and I really embody it, right? So we have for the first time, certainly in the most important industries, right? So you look at the Magnificent Seven, those tech industries, and you look at even today, like I run a software team, and my team is literally all over the world. You know, I have people in Australia, Indonesia, Toronto, Venezuela, Paris, Switzerland. Like we're all over the place. And this is so many companies are like that, which means if you're in the tech industry, you can work anywhere, right? All you need is an internet connection and some electricity. And so we've had this kind of digital nomad thing that's been going on for a long time. I'm not a digital nomad. I really have, besides a few small trips, I really haven't left, but I've been working from here. And one of the reasons we stayed was that I could work from here. But one of the things that surprised me was, why does nobody in my industry know this place exists? I mean, you mentioned when we started my time zone. I'm in the Sydney time zone. So okay. I'm in an Asia time zone. I'm 1 hour off of Seoul. Or 2 hours off of Seoul, Korea, which means I'm two hours off of Tokyo, right? I'm 3 hours off of Beijing. So if you're a U.S. software developer or a U.S. software company and you have teams in Asia or clients in Asia, which so many of them do, or let's say you're not even a software company. Let's just say you're doing sales and you're doing Asia sales. Why wouldn't you locate here? We have direct flights to Seoul. My wife will go to Seoul for just day trips for shopping. She went there to get her teeth implants. She needed a tooth implant. And so she was flying back and forth to do that. We've got direct flights to Philippines, to Hong Kong, to Tokyo. from off this island. So it's like, why? And the other thing is, we still have our own tax system. It mirrors the United States' tax system exactly, but you don't pay the IRS. If you live here for 6 months out of the year, or you source your income here from your business, the IRS is not entitled to any of it. It only goes to the local government. But the cool thing about it is, at a minimum, you get a 50% rebate. So whatever you paid to the IRS, exact same forms, by the way.
Okay.
You fill out the exact same form.
I can keep
and then
my
you just,
accountant.
Yeah, keep your accountant. Keep your accountant. Exact same forms. By law, it has to be a mirror. It's a mirror system. Exact same forms. But then at the end, cut it in half. Whatever you were going to send to them, cut it in half. Minimum. And so what I said when I got here was, I was like, wait a minute. How does no one else in my – why am I the only person like this here? And now, mind you, the weather here is room temperature 365 days a year, 24/7. It's between 75 and 85 degrees, and it never moves. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records for that. So we have a wet season and a dry season. This is weird. We haven't had a typhoon since I've been here 6 years, except for this, right?
Okay.
We have a nice, cool morning rain, a nice evening rain for 15 minutes, and the rest of the day is just beautiful. And it's beautiful, and everybody speaks English, and there's zero crime. Zero crime. It's super family-oriented. It's the great – everybody who raises kids here is like, I'm not leaving because there's nowhere better in the world to raise kids. And if you're an American, you can come here. And so I was like, why are people not coming here? And since that time, so I told you that I'm on the board of directors for our development bank. That development bank has another program where we have people here, Americans, right? Americans, businessmen who came, applied for this program for up to 25 years. They have zero taxes on their business and zero taxes personal income tax, zero. Right, because they made a minimum. They made a minimum investment.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and we started, and there was another program on the books that I helped. I told you I was working on laws. I helped to get that established, and now that exists as well. It's an economic incentive district in our main commercial district, so you can get that same thing, not on the personal, but on your business. But if you're a single member LLC, it's the same thing. Right. And you can get that within our main commercial district, so long as you locate your business in that commercial district. And so for me, I'm like, look, this is just a matter of time. This is just a matter of time. There's enough people that this works for them who are already remote workers and can work from anywhere. There's enough people who are like, I'm tired of the States. Right. And I would like to be somewhere else. But look, don't have to learn a new language. Don't have to get a visa. Don't have to drop your bank accounts, right? Still keep using your Bank of America account. That's fine. You know what I mean? Don't have to do any of those things. You're under American flag, American law. You know, the amount of – if you've got kids, digital nomads is like a lot of single guys mostly. Yeah, but if you've got – If you're a single guy, this is probably not the place to come. We have no nightlife to speak of. Like I said, it's pretty conservative.
Yeah.
But if you're married with kids, my kids run around in our neighborhood. There's 10 kids within like what would be like a block. They run around. They're swimming. They're running through the jungle. Totally safe. You know, they're living the life that I had as a childhood when I was like in the 80s. And so, for me, it's just like, it's just a matter of time before people figure out this gem of a place. And the other great part about it is that, you know, it's incredibly fertile. If you want to do agriculture, if you want to experiment with something in your business, like come do it. And, you know, I see the governor. I hung out with the governor at barbecues, our current governor. You know what I mean? I see senators out having drinks.
It's kind of a small population, right? It's like 40 to 45,000 people or something like that on the whole island.
It's a small town. It's a small town with, but it has the power of a state. We have a delegate to the Congress. They can't vote, but she introduces legislation in the Congress, U.S. Congress.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about that, my town I grew up in, Pennsylvania, Pottsville's 24,000 people. Yeah, it was
double that.
You're talking double two Pottsvilles. You're not Pottsville, Minersville, and Port Carbon, and then that's it. And but it's its own nation. And to that alone, to me, is opportunity, right? Because there has to be a whole lot of, let's say, freedom, and I don't necessarily mean codified in the law, but just like there's only so much we're going to do here to bother people, right? Like I think that's part of why it worked out for COVID, because it's like, yeah, I'm not going to go over there and tell that guy on the beach to put a mask on. Like I just, you know, that doesn't seem like it's worth my time.
And like, they've built a system where there's no incentive to mess with people. So first off, like, you might get pulled over for speeding. 80% of the time they'll let you go if they even pull you over. We don't have many cops because there's not a lot of crime, and the cops aren't very motivated here. Let's just put it like that. Half of the time you'll know them, right? Because it's just like everybody's kind of related to everybody. But then even if you do get the speeding ticket, it's $30. You know what I mean? So it's like there's the way that they've set things up here is like the
it's like a toll tag to speed, right? Like I just don't even
so
care.
You're like, I remember my wife got a ticket for blowing a stop sign, and she had gotten several warnings, and the cop was like, "Look, ma'am, I'm gonna have to do it this time." And she came in crying because she had known California and New Hampshire and Massachusetts and these places. She came in crying, "Oh God, a speeding ticket!" And I called the court and I was like, "How much is the, you know, running a stop sign?" And she was like, $25. I told my wife, "Would you stop crying?"
Would you stop crying? Gas, you know? I mean, like, so I would think like there seems like there'd be tremendous opportunity there for, again, the digital nomad, but like you mentioned, agriculture. Like it seems like if you're markets are all full of spam and you can produce something, then there's probably a market for it. Not that it maybe is going to make you wealthy or anything, but you know, it could be, but how would that work? It's like, I can't own land, right? But I guess I can lease land or
55 year lease.
Okay. Right now, I'll be dead. Okay. That's fine. I don't care.
They're pushing for a 99 year lease. They want to amend the Constitution and make it a 99 year. That's more for like the hotels and stuff for building a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah.
But the farmland here is, I mean, it's funny because there's a friend of mine. We were talking about this. We were coming from an economic summit that they had at one of the 5-star hotels here. And he's the chairman of the Economic Incentive Authority. And he's also the commissioner of the Department of Corrections. He's a good friend of mine. Great guy, Anthony Torres. And he had been like, "Hey, let me drive you to the thing and so we could talk." And then he brought me back to my house and we were talking about just how abundant the place is, these kind of concepts. And we were parked in my driveway and I brought up this abundance thing. And I was like, "Look, dude," I pointed to my left and there's a forest of banana trees. And I was like, "There's bananas hanging off the thing. This is on my property within like eye shot of us sitting in." And then I go, "And over here," and I point to the right, and there's like four papaya trees with papayas the size of watermelons. And as I'm pointing at the papaya tree, the wild jungle chickens come by, a walk underneath the papaya tree, right, with a whole bunch of chicks behind them. And the locals just, they live in the jungle, and the locals know how to teach them to lay. So the locals will teach them to lay right next to the house and just have chicken. They're
chickens
they're,
you don't have to take care of.
They call them the Saipan jungle fowl. It's actually got its own thing. They come from like the cockfighting strain. They're not huge layers, but they just are rolling on their own. But the people where I get my eggs from is my neighbor, two houses away, who's a good friend of mine. And dude, the eggs are, they'll just call me like, "You have to take some eggs. Like, you have to take some eggs. I have too many eggs. Please take eggs, take eggs, take eggs." And that's everybody here. Never mind, you know, I'm looking out my window right here. I can go down to the beach or to the cliffs, you know, just buy some frozen shrimp from the store, throw it in, chum the water, and just pull fish like this.
Yeah, yeah, that's where I was going next, because me and fish, that's my that's my love language. I'm actually like, as soon as I'm done with you, I'm wrapping everything up here tomorrow. I'm out the door with my grandson. We're going out into the Gulf for a couple days, shark fishing and things like that. So when I think of Saipan, all I can think of is there's blue water and fish everywhere.
And this place, in terms of, I mean, that's another, you know, in terms of opportunity, right? I remember coming here. So every morning, just along the main drag, you can go and get fresh fish that just came in, right? Cheap. Tunas. So sashimi is the big thing here, right? This part of their, but like sashimi grade tuna, that it's actually a skipjack variety, but the sashimi is incredible, right? But when I came here, I was like going to all of these places and I was like, hey, but do you just have like a fillet? And they looked at me like I was a crazy person.
Sure.
Right? Like, what, you can't cut your own fish? But again, in the stores, you imagine, here's a little fish thing where they're selling a full fish. Right next to it is a store with a chiller. I can't buy a skipjack fillet in the store, a local skipjack fillet. But I can buy, you know what I could buy at the bigger stores is I could buy imported salmon fillets. But I can't buy a local skipjack fillet. If I want that, I got to buy the whole tuna and fillet it myself, which I can do. But like, do I really want to do that? Or do I just want a fresh fillet? So it's like, there's no culture. There's never been a culture of entrepreneurship here. Any entrepreneur coming here, you're immediately going to be like, oh, I could sell that. I could sell that. I could sell that. I could sell. And it's always successful. Always successful.
Yeah. Because you've got a low base level price and a small service add-on, like a value add.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a market that's like, I would buy this, but it's not available, but I can make it available. And there's probably not a lot of, like, I can't even imagine the bullshit that I would go through if I like this. I'm going to move to Galveston, right? And I'm going to start, like, taking the fish right off the boat and filleting it and making sashimi and providing it at the beach.
You could do that here and nobody would say
Galveston is pack of permits.
Oh dude, no. You couldn't do it. So we have one sushi place here called Himawari that's also a Japanese store and everybody goes there. And in the afternoons, they have fresh poke bowls that are in there. You just go and buy the poke bowl that's all fresh fish that just came in that day. Hmm. Right? And they have just regular sashimi that you could buy like $6 for a big thing of sashimi. I think the poke bowl is like $5. It's brand new, fresh. I love it. It's so good. But all of the fish, I know the guys who are fishing, they don't have a business license. They don't have nothing.
Yeah.
They just go out in the morning on the boat. I know the guys they borrow the boats from. It's not even their boats. Those guys are just like, hey, you need to feed your family. Pay me for the gas. They go out in the morning, they go fishing, they come back with all the tuna, they go and sell it to Himawari for cash. Himawari chops it up, puts it in the thing. Those guys go home, they feed their family with that. That's the culture here.
That's beautiful. That's the way life should be.
That's why I'm never leaving this place.
the old story about the businessman in Mexico that talks to the fisherman and it goes on and on and on, but basically it gets to why would I buy boats and all these? Well, then one day you could retire and you could live in a place, and he describes exactly how the guy's already living. Exactly. Right? Like, so why would I do this? I play the guitar, he says, I go some fishing and whatever, and like I get why you fell in love with the place.
And look, I want to say I hope that this is sparking some things off in your audience, because it's really come to me that like the elites here, I mean, it is an aristocracy, right?
Sure.
Most of us have no idea what an aristocracy is. If you want to know what it was like, which wasn't that long ago, 400 or 500 years ago, maybe not even 300 in some places. Like, you have a landed gentry. They want to make their money off rent at the end of the day, right? Mm-hmm. They want to rent you something. That's what they want. But besides that, there are very simple people. They're also very kind. This is probably the least racist place I've ever been. It's only 2% white, by the way.
Okay.
Like, if you are of whatever race, I mean, I'll hear 4 and 5 languages in a day.
Sure.
Walking around, you know, Everybody is integrated. Everybody's intermarried. The elites have intermarried with Filipinos and Chinese and white Americans and whatever. So everybody looks all mixed up. You're like, are you Asian? Are you Mexican? Like, what are you? What are? Oh, you're white. I thought you were Chamorro. Like, I don't really understand what's going on. Yeah, like this is crazy. And Russians and whatever. But yeah. The opportunity here that I've seen is really for this is a place that Americans have not known exists. But there's huge opportunity here, particularly for Americans, and. The amount, I think especially lately, the people who have been here for a long time who are American, particularly entrepreneurs, are getting a lot of opportunities because the U.S. has cut off Chinese entrepreneurs who had been the lifeblood.
Okay.
So our opportunity is basically Trump's war with and the neocons' war with China. This place had survived off Chinese entrepreneurs being the ones to come and take advantage of the opportunities here. Because they were closest, obviously, the biggest right close there. Environment, right? Yeah. But yeah. Biggest closest economy. But now that, yeah, we're so close, we're, 4-hour flight. But now that Chinese businessmen are not being allowed to participate in the economy here, it leaves open for U.S. businessmen who don't need a visa, can come here and work immediately. You know what I mean? Have, as you say, don't even have to switch accountants. To come here and to take over all of those things and not take over in a bad way, but the elites don't want to do it, right? They want to be the landlord. They're looking for the tenants to fill in their commercial space that the Chinese abandoned, literally abandoned. There's hotels that are sitting abandoned that are furnished. One of my buddies just took one over. If people go to CasaMarianas.com, this is my business partner who came here with the stablecoin project that we're working on. He came here 2 years ago. He basically just went to the Chinese kind of pseudo owner of this place. He was like, yeah, the hotel is fully furnished. We just haven't had tourists. And he was like, hey, I want to do a co-working space. And I want to have a place for digital nomads to come. And the guy was like, oh, bet. Just go half with me. I'll pay for everything. You just run it. Go half with me. He owns a hotel now. He owns a hotel. And it was up
in a monopoly game to get to a hotel, right? I mean,
and it's on the beach. It's the beach on Beach Road. It's called the Gold Beach Hotel.
That's crazy.
And when the typhoon hit, they had just gotten up and running, and they just dedicated themselves to, we're going to make sure we have power. We're going to make sure we have fast internet. They went through like 10 generators, but it ended up that all the FEMA people and the Red Cross people, there was no place for them to stay. They stayed at this hotel, basically subsidized the whole thing, right? And so now they have movie nights over there. You could go CasaMarianas.com. Look, if you need to come out and you want to stay for a month's stay, boom, you get your little month stay there. They got super fast fiber internet. They got a co-working space. They got a little cafe down there. And this dude just came in. He's been here 3 years, I think.
Yeah, I think the thing is you keep bringing up the elites, and I think that we're talking about a different species of elite, I guess maybe. Like, the problem that we have with elites in this country isn't that they have a lot of shit. I think at least the people that want to work hard for their own thing. I don't really care how much somebody else has. The problem we have with the elites here is they won't leave you alone.
Right.
They're always in your way. They're always putting up obstacles. They're always complicating your life. And I think it's just because of the sheer size. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many elites here competing for so much of the theft that they have to interfere with people's lives to get it. If the elites just did their thing and left everybody alone, I think we would care about it a lot less. And that sounds like what you're describing.
Well, man, you've brought up such a good point, Jack. One of the positive offshoots of the donation state and cargo culture is the amount of money that comes. So our current budget, that's the general fund that was that came from taxes. We've been blown out this year. Like we've been destroyed, our economy. So it's been usually about $200 million a year. This year it's like $95 million for the year. That's what they got in taxes from the internal taxes. The government budget in terms of grants, welfare, Social Security, Medicaid, unemployment, all of that stuff is $1.5 billion. So for them, they don't care to try to steal from you here on the island. Their stealing eyes is focused on the where the money's at, which is D.C. Sure.
Well, that would make perfect sense, right? Yeah,
they want a military contract to give it to give it to their family. They want a grant. We've got an $80 million broadband grant that has been there for 4 years. When you look at their 5-year plan, it's just how do we hire more people? The broadband situation hasn't changed. That $80 million is just going to people's families and their political connections and whatever. And we have all those grants to build roads, grants to, you know, improve the power supply. That's where they're looking. They don't care about your business. Many people don't even report taxes. It's a huge problem of underreporting, and they have no one to audit, for better or worse.
They don't care either, because what am I going to do? I'm going to go get $5,000 from this guy or something by shaking him upside down, pissing him off, by the way, and upsetting the natives, where I can just say, hey, D.C., we need some more money, and somebody will throw me $500 million. Okay, I'm doing that. Yeah. Right. That's that's following incentives. Right. Like, that's exactly. One of my favorite quotes from Charlie Munger is, never be thinking about anything else when you should be thinking about incentives.
That's right.
So the elite's incentive is get money from Daddy Washington.
That's right.
Right. Because if I were able to extort the entire population of the island, I can still get more money easier over here. Like, just basic 101 incentives.
Which is the reason why they actually have programs where, and again, incentives, right? So they literally have two programs where they're like, come and do the businesses that we want, which includes all kinds of different businesses, but mostly productive businesses or internet-related businesses. Come and do those here, and we'll give you no taxes for 20 years. We would rather you employed people. We would rather you were filling up space. We would rather you were developing a hotel property. We would rather that you were taking your money and putting it here to develop something, rather than we take taxes from you. Right? Yeah. We'll get your payroll taxes.
Yeah.
That's fine. The people still have to.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You bring an employer in, and then you tax the income that they pay their people.
That's right.
Because companies tend to reinvest in their businesses.
That's right.
Like, this idea, like, one of the things they used to, like, class warfare us all is like, this person's worth this much money. No, they're not. That's the total equity that they have in all their companies. And that's if you made them liquidated to give it to you, it would become worthless overnight. Go ahead and try to sell $500 million worth of stock in 24 hours.
Can't do it.
What's going to happen?
You crash the price. Right?
That is a paper number that they love because they can borrow against it and create tax-free cash flow. So just let them freaking keep it. I mean, I know that sounds insane, but like, personal income tax, corporate income, don't worry about it, because a lot of the bullshit they only do it because they're taxed. That's right. Like, I used to say all the time, when I was running a company, and I'm like, if we didn't have to pay this freaking tax, I could hire 5 more people tomorrow.
Oh, and you would.
And of course I would.
Of course you'd expand your business. Why wouldn't
you? That's the person doesn't understand anything about a business. If I can hire 5 more really good, high qualified people, I'm talking people I'm paying $100,000 a year and total cost is like $175,000. If I can hire those people and I have something to do with them, of course I'm going to hire them. Why
not? More money. You'll make exponentially more money, right?
Yes. Right, and then they're all going to pay taxes, and then they're all going to contribute to the local economy. And then
that's right.
What I'm hearing from you is, because you're in this kind of like contained ecosystem, it's like a 45,000 person Truman Show in a way, but nobody's watching it, because it's such a small. It does mirror, you mentioned earlier, like the Gulf states and what they did, and it's because they have this little tiny piece of land, not that many people, huge resource in petroleum and gas. And so the amount of money per capita is through the roof. It's just Saipan's getting their money from Washington instead of from
– right.
Or a lot of their money. I shouldn't say their money, but a lot of their money.
So that's the transition, and that goes to, you know, as we're talking about this decay, the response to these two – we just had two super typhoons, Sinlaku and Bavi. People could look them up. It was insane. Category 5 – Sinlaku lasted for 50 hours. It was 50 hours of Category 5, right, that hit us. I have never experienced anything like this. Don't want to experience it again. But look, we had no fatalities. The people here are super prepared for this. But unlike other typhoons that we've had, the elites were actually quite, they're in a bit of shock still, and that was April, that the U.S. didn't really respond. There was nothing. The aid didn't really come. The money didn't really come. It's been very weird. We got hit, 2018, there was a huge Typhoon U2, another super typhoon. What was still left over in terms of the aid from U2 when we got here in 2020 was impressive. There's nothing. There's nothing. We still have 1,000 customers out of 14,000 without power here, because they didn't have enough power poles and transformers. So it's been different. The opportunity here. So like you mentioned the Gulf states, you know, they have oil. We don't have oil, you know, but what we have is incentives, and we have incentives for U.S. digital businesses. Well, what are the highest market cap? What are the highest market cap businesses in the world? U.S. digital businesses.
The other thing is I can ship weightless. That's why. Like I have no cost of delivery.
And the other thing that we have
development, and I have cost of supporting my customer. I have no other costs.
And it's becoming less on the individual person side right now for those companies because we have AI, right? So that's really been a force multiplier. But you could have one guy working on an AI product, and every sale out of that product that was sourced from here, you could be under one of these things and pay no taxes as a U.S. company and be not liable to the IRS. Not only that, we have no cap on our H-1B visas. So all these companies are hitting the H-1B visa cap. And the U.S. is like, we don't want Trump. We don't want any more H-1Bs. We don't want, you know, that was that whole thing. Hey, put them out here where they can't get into the U.S. You want to bring them? We have no cap. You want to bring 1,000 H-1Bs to work in your division at Apple and they're getting capped out, but you'd like to have these people? Open an office in Saipan. Bring them here, and all of the income that comes from out of that division, tax-free.
That's crazy.
We'll set you up with that tomorrow.
It's even just without nobody the knows about structure, it. The idea for me that I could keep half more of my my tax bill literally goes in half. That alone, right?
Oh, that's, no, Jack, you'd be able to keep all of it because you have an internet-based business.
Okay,
you'd be able to come underneath maybe not all of it. Maybe you'd have a 2% effective tax rate.
That shit.
Because you'd come under one of these programs that we have.
I see. Yeah, so I would
50%.
That's more than my housing budget right there by itself, right? That's
dude. 50%, Jack, would be if you took advantage of nothing extra. If you just came in cold,
even that. I mean,
right? And that's what I'm saying. 50% is great, but now we have these programs.
That's insane. That's insane. So
it's just that nobody knows, Jack. Nobody knows. That's why I'm here. I almost feel bad. It's like when you're in one of these situations, I've struggled with this, Jack, and you're like, oh, why has this guy not been around? This is why I haven't been around.
No,
I've been like, I've got the secret sauce. I don't want to tell anybody because it's like you've got the secret location. You got the secret fishing spot. I don't want everybody to show up. But you know what? With what's going on, with writing this book, with participating with the people, with falling in love with this place and wanting to do good and a lot of prayer – in prayer, it's been like, you got to tell people.
Yeah.
You got to tell people.
And 1 in 10,000 are going to do it anyway, because it's not hard, but it's still significant change of life and movement. Let's hit a couple questions quick here. This is one I had myself, but I waited till the end because somebody else asked it. Angie says, what's the healthcare situation there? I mean, a lot of us, you know, I'm in my 50s now. We're hitting toward retirement, at least retirement age. I have no plans to fully retire. But as you age, you need more and more healthcare. So what's that like?
This is important, and it was something that I was going to say afterwards because there's a larger thing that I was going to say after what you just said, Jack, okay. in terms of the trade-off of moving here.
Okay.
So if you are someone who is very dependent on the infrastructure of empire.
Okay.
The things that you take for granted, right, which is a super advanced healthcare system, right? If you need if you need support from the government, right? If you are on food stamps, if you have some, you know, if you think you're going to move somewhere and, oh yeah, I'm going to have this Medicaid or whatever, it's like, look, that's for the locals here.
Yeah.
And maybe if you know somebody, you ain't getting food stamps.
Yeah.
Every local is going to get it. Right.
Yeah.
But they look at you, especially if you're a white American, and there's been a lot of problems with that here. They're not out to help you if they don't know you.
I got right? you.
Now, if you've been here for a while and you're doing stuff and you know, and then it's like, okay, it's no problem. If you're a positive person, they see you at church, that whatever, then it's like, okay, fine. Otherwise, it's like, this is somebody, because the big problem that they have, especially with Americans, is that this is a place that people come to hide when they've done something bad.
Okay.
Right. So the immediate thought when they see somebody new who's an American is, what is this guy running from? What is okay. Is he a murderer, a child molester? We have those problems here. Right.
Okay.
Because it's an out of the way place that people try to come to. Right. So you should
it's
know.
It's easy to do it. Right. Yeah.
Right. And you don't. And again, because it's like very laissez-faire, whatever. People get away. You could look in the news and see we extradite people all the time because we catch them here.
Okay.
Right? Who had run here from doing something. So if you can be like me, I was able to come and I had income. Right? I could be self-sufficient. I didn't need the support of the government. I have a young family that's healthy. And in terms of like in terms of healthcare, we have a few small clinics. We have one hospital. For just your average things that you need, it's actually pretty – it's the hospital is fine. It's all like American doctors and Filipino nurses. And we just passed the thing to be able to get more doctors from Philippines. But like if you've got a kid's got an ear infection or a broken bone or, you know, all of these sorts of things, you go to the emergency room or you go to the outpatient clinic, perfectly fine. If you've got something more advanced than that, right? If you've got something that's like a serious health thing, we actually do have, because they chew betel nut and stuff, so there's actually a high prevalence of especially like mouth and lip cancers here.
Yeah,
so like
we have an cancer treatment.
Yep, we have an oncology center, we have dialysis, we have those sorts of things. But in general, if people are going to be here and they need something more, you can get the like expat health insurance here, like there's many different ones. This is considered actually a foreign location, which is nice. So okay. Blue Cross even has like a really good one. But you can go with that, or if you want to pay cash, go to Philippines, fly to Philippines, fly to Korea, fly to Japan. Like I said, my wife needed a tooth implant. Dentistry here is fine. The dentists, if you need a filling, if you need your teeth cleaned, they're great. It's Filipinos who have come here. It's probably the same Filipinos that would be doing your stuff if you're in the States, right? So it's like they're here. The quality is good. But if you need something like a tooth implant, it's way more expensive here actually than to Korea.
Okay.
I know a lot of people who will go and get what they call their executive checkup in Philippines. They'll just take a week vacation to Philippines. There's all these places over there that do like executive checkups. Very advanced. They do all your blood, your hormone work, everything, and it's super cheap. Pay cash, right? But the quality is very high. This is the same thing people are doing in Mexico now with the clinics going down there.
Medical
so you
tourism.
Have that medical tourism. So that's something. But if you kind of need a constant care here, if there's some real serious medical condition that you have, and you don't have a lot of funds, if you know you have that sort of chronic medical condition or your children or family, living here is probably not what you want to do.
Gotcha.
If it could be something where overnight I'm going to need to go and see a specialist, probably not where you want to be. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. I just wanted to, I grabbed this one for you just because it's kind of a shout out to you from somebody listening to us. Hey, Vin, love your book, Render Onto Caesar. I know you said it would only be purchased with Bitcoin, but I bought it on Amazon before you pulled it off. Because of that, I can still repurchase it. So just wanted you to know that person was here chatting.
Yeah. Awesome.
Cool.
Man, this is really cool. Hey, Alabama says all I need is the local herbalist. And I, you know, it sounds like the way that an American goes to Saipan is the way that if we ran immigration in the United States that way, these open borders people, I would agree with them. Like, you show up, you do your thing, you support yourself, don't ask us for charity, because if you needed it, why did you come here?
Right.
And you want me to open borders, you give me that and come on in. But that's not what we have. And that's how you make that sustainable. Like, who's going to go to Saipan? Somebody that's kind of adventurous, still wants to build something, has some financial resources, et cetera. If you just gave out welfare to anybody that went to Saipan and it's a freaking tropical paradise.
Right.
Every vagrant that could get on a boat would end up there, right? That's how that would work, right? We can't have that, and you'll destroy what you've got with that. If somebody does want to learn more about this, what should they do? They want to consider going.
Well, from a business standpoint, I have my company, the Saipan team. So I basically set that up to help people if they wanted to get their business stuff set up. So that's saipan.team, saipan.team. Also, like I said, Casa Marianas is my friend, and my friend Blaine. And he runs that, and the crew over there can answer lots of questions for you. That's more if you want to kind of like have the base to kind of get set up. If you want to just see the things that are going on here, you could check out like our local news, Marianas Variety. So that's mvariety.com, or Marianas Press on Facebook is pretty cool to see the stuff that's going on here. What else? So I don't know if you know these travel bloggers. They're very popular. They're called Yes Theory. They're on YouTube. Probably some of your audience knows them. Very, very popular. And they did a 3 or 4 part series here. They just fell in love with the place. So if you want to get some idea from like a travel standpoint of what it's like here, you could go and check out their videos from Yes Theory. It was one of their most popular video series, and it's recent. It's only within like the last year or two. So you could definitely check any of those things out. And people can reach out to me. You can actually reach out to me through the Saipan team contact that's there. And I'm always happy to talk to people. But again, you know, a lot of people have a vision of, oh, I'm going to go out there and I'm just like going to find work when I get there. That ain't it. That ain't it, Chief.
I can tell that ain't it.
Yeah, that ain't it. That ain't it, Chief. Like, you're not, even if you're in the trades, one thing you should know is our minimum wage is the federal minimum wage. We used to have our own minimum wage during the Chinese garment days. That's why they came here, and it was $2 an hour.
Oh,
right now for the trades, we basically import all of our labor. We have a special visa program that only we have, and it's almost all Filipinos and Bangladeshis. So we have some great tradesmen who are here, but they're making minimum wage. Electricians here make like $16,000 a year, you know what I mean? Okay. But they're great electricians. So even if you're in the trades, it's not going to happen. But if you are somebody who has some income or has some savings, who's going to come here and a great place to retire, it really is a low cost of living for what you get. And if you want to kind of establish yourself here and have a deep impact on whatever's going to come next, especially if you have a digital business. But even if you want to do something and maybe do some exports or something like that back to the States, this is a great place. There's a lot to be unlocked. I just found out that there's, that we're in the coffee belt. One of our islands, Rota, has thousands of wild coffee trees that were planted. There's actually a group from Kansas City that's exploring coming out here and helping with the coffee industry. They have not really done it since the Japanese times out here, but it'll be the only other coffee other than Kona under a U.S. flag, because none of the rest of the U.S. is in the coffee belt. So there you've got, you know, it grows even wild here. So these are the types of things that, like, there's endless opportunities.
With no import tax.
No import tax. No import tax.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yep.
That's interesting.
Yep. So just imagine.
Actual fair trade coffee.
Yes.
It would be actual fair trade, because you wouldn't have anybody taking a piece of it, right?
No, and you could do a 55-year lease on land in Rota. They'd love to have you do that. Other thing about Rota that's really interesting, it has a water plant that's kind of in disrepair, but Rota has, people could look up Rota water. There's probably not a ton about it, but it is like, it's like the best aquifer water in the world. It could just be pumped out and put into bottles and shipped into the US. So like you have all of these things with stories, and it's just like a Korean company was doing it and shipping it into Korea, and then they just left at some point.
Okay.
But this is pristine. There's only 1,000 people that live on Rota. It's probably the most beautiful place I've ever been. Absolutely pristine. It's got all of these cool trace minerals that are in it. It's just fantastic. And an American can come in and do that. No visa, no nothing. And you could get the tax break on that one, right? That would be one they'd love to give you a tax break on.
This is Gulch in a way.
It is.
There's nothing in the way except whether you're willing to do it or not. So
that's it.
I'll definitely add those other sites that you mentioned to the resource section today in the show notes. If you're watching Vin and I live on video, right down in the video notes, there's a link that'll go over to the blog post. That'll go out about 30 minutes after we wrap up, which is coming soon, and you'll be able to get all those resources. So if you had to be listening to this a day or two after we did it and you're driving or something, you want all that stuff, you can pull it up. Now, that Casa something
Casa Marianas. Said, Casa Marianas.
One of our people in the chat says that probably one of your people from your tech division needs to get with them. It's considered unsecure. They probably just have an expired cert.
I think probably an expired cert.
Yeah, probably that's probably cert. A 5-minute fix, right?
Yeah.
I
but again, look, again, this is like these are the opportunities.
Yeah, yeah.
Like this, somebody needs to get with them. You get with them.
Yeah.
you get with them. That's how it is here. You know, I'll give you an example. Again, like the fish fillets.
Yeah.
Right? Where I'm like, do you have a fillet? And they looked at me crazy. It's the same thing of like, oh, I need to hire somebody to, you know, fix my gate.
Like, why would you do that? Why don't you fix your own gate, right?
Who? They're like, I call somebody and be like, hey, do you know a good plumber?
Yeah.
They're like, what's wrong?
Yeah.
Oh, my pipes, I need them snaked. They're like, there's snakes at Ace.
Yeah.
Go buy a snake at Ace. Oh no, go rent you need something bigger? Go rent a snake from Art Man.
Yeah.
It's like, oh wait, I got to do it.
Yeah,
you got to do it.
Freedom comes with responsibility. I've always said that. Every right has a corresponding responsibility, right? Like that's just basic humans 101. We're just very divorced from that. Anyway, Vin, this has been great. I'm glad that I got a chance to catch up with you. There's not a lot of people I do a 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. interview with.
You're worth
doing it with, man. And I really appreciate you being with us today. Folks, I'll have all the links, including links where you can get Vin's book. I highly recommend you read it. Whether you are interested in visiting or going to Saipan or not, I think you can learn a lot from it about what empire looks like when it's on its last legs. And I think that's where we are. But I always try to be careful when I say that, Vin, because I think when you say that, people are like, well, that'll be tomorrow. Now, like, if you look at one, like, Rome started going down the toilet, it was over 300 years of going down the toilet. So, but you will see these fringes begin to crumble first, and that's actually more opportunity for a place like Saipan, because the less there is of the grifting from our controllers, the more opportunity there is for local development. So, man, again, thanks for being on with us today, Vin.
Thanks, Jack. It's been a pleasure. So good to reconnect with you, and the context of it is just magical. So, man, thank you so much.
No problem, man. Take care. All right, real quick before I wrap up, late in the day and all, I want to get ready to get out of here, but our item of the day today is on of a hell of a good sale, as long as it hasn't gone off sale, because it's on one of these limited time deals. This is the Olight Arcfield Ultra EDC flashlight. That's our item of the day today. It's 40% off. Let me tell you something about this light. This is a big EDC community. Everybody in this community has some sort of EDC, and you always want a good light to have on you at all times. This light, two of my best friends in the world carry this exact light. We were on a fishing trip about 6 months ago, and we're all talking, do a pocket dump. Everybody's got the same light.
Not because we all told each other about it, because we all did our own independent research about the best light for an EDC. The way this thing carries is beautiful. It has UV. It has a pointer, a laser pointer. It also has a really strong light, recharged with a magnetic charger so it doesn't ever get clogged up or messed up or broken or what have you. If you need extra charging cables, they're $9 a piece. This is just a great lit. The form factor actually fits in a pocket beautifully. About the only problem I ever had with it is going into a place where they're like, you can bring that in, but you can't vape. You're like, dude, it's not a vape. It's a flashlight. You can't vape. All right, man, whatever. Other than that, it's just been fantastic. 40% off. And I'll tell you, like, one of my best friends from like way back in the day, before any of you guys knew who I was, works for these people. This is just really tightly woven into our community. I've sold, God, I bet you since the first time I brought this around, I've sold 1,000 of these things. Easy. Zero complaints. Don't expect to ever get any. Check it out. And remember, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. And if you do not own yet a copy of my most recently released book, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life, please consider picking that up as well. And I really recommend you consider the hardcover. I've done them both in soft jacket and hardcover. You know, it's a few bucks more for the hardcover. I make less on the hardcover. It's just so much better quality. And I would tell you guys, any of you guys that are out there that are authors yourselves, that are looking at Amazon KDP, you know, it's not the greatest program, but it's a damn good program. It's easy to use. There's tons of people to help you with it. And no matter what you do, if you do KDP, go ahead and pay your designer a little extra money for the hardcover design, a couple bucks extra, because it's basically the same thing with a little bit of a different setting, and include it, because it is just a much better thing. With that, I also remind you again, I'm going to be in West Virginia as a keynote speaker for the West Virginia Homeschool Association on August 29th, and that evening at my hotel, we are doing a meetup, and there's information about that on the website as well. With that, I'll catch you guys again on Tuesday with a brand new episode. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have